Chapter 115. He unwilling brain feigns often what it would not, and we trust imagination with such fantasies as the tongue dares not fashion into words, which have no words, their horror makes them dim to the mind's eye. Shelley. Madonna Pia, whose husband, feeling himself injured by her, took her to his castle amid the swampy flats of the Maremma, and got rid of her there, makes a pathetic figure in dance purgatory, among the sinners who repented at the last, and desire to be remembered compassionately by their fellow countrymen. We know little about the grounds of mutual discontent between the Siamese couple, but we may infer with some confidence that the husband had never been a very delightful companion, and that on the flats of the Maremma his disagreeable manners had a background which threw them out remarkably, whence in his desire to punish his wife to the utmost, the nature of things was so far against him that in relieving himself of her, he could not avoid making the relief mutual. And thus, without any hardness to the poor Tuscan lady, who had her deliverance long ago, one may feel warranted in thinking of her with a less sympathetic interest than of the better known Gwendolyn, who, instead of being delivered from her errors or earth, and cleansed from their effect in purgatory, is at the very height of her entanglement in those fatal meshes which are woven within more closely than without, and often make the inward torture disproportionate to what is discernible as outward cause. In taking his wife with him on a yachting expedition, Grandcourt had no intention to get rid of her. On the contrary, he wanted to feel more securely that she was his to do as he liked with, and to make her feel it also. Moreover, he was himself very fond of yachting. Extremely do-nothing absolutism, unmolested by social demands, suited his disposition, and he did not in the least regard it as an equivalent for the dreariness of the Maremma. He had his reasons for carrying Gwendolyn out of reach, but they were not reasons that can seem black in the mere statement. He suspected a growing spirit of opposition in her, and his feeling about the sentimental inclination she betrayed for Deronda was what in another man he would have called jealousy. In himself it seemed merely a resolution to put an end to such foolery as must have been going on in that prearranged visit of Deronda's which he had divined and interrupted. And Grandcourt might have pleaded that he was perfectly justified in taking care that his wife should fulfill the obligations as he had accepted. Her marriage was a contract where all the ostensible advantages were on her side, and it was only of those advantages that her husband should use his power to hinder her from any injurious self-committal or unsuitable behavior. He knew quite well that as he had not married him but not overcome her repugnance to certain facts out of love to him personally, he had won her by the rank and luxuries he had to give her, and these she had got. He had fulfilled his side of the contract. And Gwendolyn, we know, was thoroughly aware of the situation. She could not excuse herself by saying that there had been a tacit part of the contract on her side, namely, that she meant to rule and have her own way. With all her early indulgence in the disposition to dominate, she was not one of the narrow-brained women who through life regard all their own selfish demands as rights, and every claim upon themselves as an injury. As he had a root of conscience in her, and the process of purgatory had begun for her on the green earth, she knew that as he had been wrong. But now enter into the soul of this young creature as she found herself, with the blue Mediterranean dividing her from the world, on the tiny plank island of a yacht, the domain of the husband to whom she felt that as he had sold herself, and had been paid the strict price, nay, paid more than as he had dared to ask in the handsome maintenance of her mother, the husband to whom as he had sold her truthfulness and sense of justice, so that he held them throttled into silence, collared and dragged behind him to witness what he would, without remonstrance. What had she to complain of? The yacht was of the prettiest, the cabin fitted up to perfection, smelling of cedar, soft cushioned, hung with silk, expanded with mirrors, the crew such as suited an elegant toy, one of them having even ringlets, as well as a bronze complexion and fine teeth. and Mr. Lush was not there, for he had taken his way back to England as soon as he had seen all and everything on board. Moreover, Gwendolyn herself liked the sea. It did not make her ill, and to observe the rigging of the vessel and forecast the necessary adjustments was a sort of amusement that might have gratified her activity and enjoyment of imaginary rule. The weather was fine, and they were coasting southward, where even the rain furrowed, heat-cracked clay becomes gem-like with purple shadows, and where one may float between blue and blue in an open-eyed dream that the world has done with sorrow. But what can still that hunger of the heart which sickens the eye for beauty, and makes sweet-scented ease an oppression? What sort of Moslem paradise would quiet the terrible fury of moral repulsion and cowed resistance which, like an eating pain intensifying into torture, concentrates the mind in that poisonous misery? While Gwendolyn, throned on her cushions at evening, and beholding the glory of sea and sky softening, as if with boundless love around her, was hoping that Grandcourt in his march up and down was not going to pause near her, not going to look at her, or speak to her, some woman, under a smoky sky, obliged to consider the price of eggs in arranging her dinner, was listening for the music of a footstep that would remove all risk from her foretaste of joy. Some couple, bending cheek by cheek, over a bit of work done by the one, and delighted in by the other, were reckoning the earnings that would make them rich enough for a holiday among the furs and heather. Had Grandcourt the least conception of what was going on in the breast of his wife? He conceived that she did not love him, but was that necessary? She was under his power, and he was not accustomed to soothe himself, as some cheerfully disposed persons are, with the conviction that he was very generally and justly beloved. But what lay quite away from his conception was that she could have any special repulsion for him personally. How could she? He himself knew what personal repulsion was nobody better. His mind was much furnished with a sense of what brutes his fellow creatures were, both masculine and feminine, what odious familiarities they had, what smirks, what modes of flourishing their handkerchiefs, what costume, what lavender water, what bulging eyes, and what foolish notions of making themselves agreeable by remarks which were not wanted. In this critical view of mankind there was an affinity between him and Gwendolyn before their marriage, and we know that as he had been attractingly wrought upon by the refined negations he presented to her. Hence he understood her repulsion for Lush. But how was he to understand or conceive her present repulsion for Henley Grandcourt? Some men bring themselves to believe, and not merely maintain, the non-existence of an external world. A few others believe themselves objects of repulsion to a woman without being told so in plain language. But Grandcourt did not belong to this eccentric body of thinkers. He had all his life had reason to take a flattering view of his own attractiveness, and to place himself in fine antithesis to the men who, he saw at once, must be revolting to a woman of taste. He had no idea of moral repulsion, and could not have believed, if he had been told it, that there may be a resentment and disgust which will gradually make beauty more detestable than ugliness, through exasperation at that outward virtue in which hateful things can flaunt themselves or find a supercilious advantage. How, then, could Grandcourt divine what was going on in Gwendolyn's breast? For their behavior to each other scandalized no observer, not even the foreign maid, warranted against seasickness, nor Grandcourt's own experienced valet. Still less the picturesque crew, who regarded them as a model couple in high life. Their companionship consisted chiefly in a well-bred silence. Grandcourt had no humorous observations at which Gwendolyn could refuse to smile, no chit-chat to make small occasions of dispute. He was perfectly polite in arranging an additional garment over her when needful, and in handing her any object that he perceived her to need, and she could not fall into the vulgarity of accepting or rejecting such politeness rudely. Grandcourt put up his telescope and said, "There's a plantation of sugar canes at the foot of that rock. Should you like to look?" Gwendolyn said, "Yes, please," remembering that she must try and interest herself in sugar canes as something outside her personal affairs. Then Grandcourt would walk up and down and smoke for a long while, pausing occasionally to point out a sail on the horizon, and at last would seat himself and look at Gwendolyn with his narrow, immovable gaze, as if she were part of the complete yacht, while she, conscious of being looked at, was exerting her ingenuity not to meet his eyes. At dinner he would remark that the fruit was getting stale, and they must put in somewhere for more, or, observing that she did not drink the wine, he asked her if she would like any other kind better. A lady was obliged to respond to these things suitably, and even if as he had not shrunk from quarreling on other grounds, quarreling with Grandcourt was impossible, she might as well have made angry remarks to a dangerous serpent ornamentally coiled in her cabin without invitation. And what sort of dispute could a woman of any pride and dignity begin on a yacht? Grandcourt had intense satisfaction in leading his wife captive after this fashion. It gave their life on a small scale a royal representation and publicity in which everything familiar was got rid of, and everybody must do what was expected of them, whatever might be their private protest. The protest kept strictly private, adding to the piquancy of despotism. To Gwendolyn, who even in the freedom of her maiden time had had very faint glimpses of any heroism or sublimity, the medium that now thrust itself everywhere before her view was this husband and her relation to him. The beings closest to us, whether in love or hate, are often virtually our interpreters of the world, and some feather-headed gentleman or lady whom in passing we regret to take as legal tender for a human being, may be acting as a melancholy theory of life in the minds of those who live with them like a piece of yellow and wavy glass that distorts form and makes color an affliction. Their trivial sentences, their petty standards, their low suspicions, their loveless ennui, may be making somebody else's life no better than a promenade through a pantheon of ugly idols. Gwendolyn had that kind of window before her, affecting the distant equally with the near. Some unhappy wives are soothed by the possibility that they may become mothers, but Gwendolyn felt that to desire a child for herself would have been a consenting to the completion of the injurious he had been guilty of. She was reduced to dread lest she should become a mother. It was not the image of a new sweetly budding life that came as a vision of deliverance from the monotony of distaste. It was an image of another sort. In the irritable, fluctuating stages of despair, gleams of hope came in the form of some possible accident. To dwell on the benignity of accident was a refuge from worse temptation. The embitterment of hatred is often as unaccountable to onlookers as the growth of devoted love, and it not only seems, but is really out of direct relation with any outward causes to be alleged. Passion is of the nature of seed, and finds nourishment within, tending to a predominance which determines all currents toward itself, and makes the whole life its tributary. And the intensest form of hatred is that rooted in fear, which compels to silence, and drives vehemence into a constructive vindictiveness, an imaginary annihilation of the detested object, something like the hidden rites of vengeance with which the persecuted have made a dark vent for their rage, and soothed their suffering into dumbness. Such hidden rites went on in the secrecy of Gwendolyn's mind, but not with soothing effect, rather with the effect of a struggling terror. Side by side with the dread of her husband, had grown the self-dread, which urged her to flee from the pursuing images wrought by her pent-up impulse. The vision of her past wrongdoing, and what it had brought on her, came with a pale ghastly illumination over every imagined deed that was a rash effort at freedom, such as he had made in her marriage. Moreover, as he had learned to see all her acts through the impression they would make on Deronda, whatever relief might come to her, she could not sever it from the judgment of her that would be created in his mind. Not one word of flattery, of indulgence, of dependence on her favor, could be fastened on by her in all their intercourse, to weaken his restraining power over her in this way. Deronda's effort over himself was repaid, and amid the dreary uncertainties of her spoiled life, the possible remedies that lay in his mind, nay, the remedy that lay in her feeling for him, made her only hope. He seemed to her a terrible brown angel, from whom she could not think of concealing any deed so as to win an ignorant regard from him. It belonged to the nature of their relation that she should be truthful, for his power over her had begun in the raising of a self-discontent which could be satisfied only by genuine change. But in no concealment had she now any confidence. Her vision of what else he had to dread took more decidedly than ever the form of some fiercely impulsive deed, committed as in a dream, that she would instantaneously wake from to find the effects real, though the images had been false. To find death under her hands, but instead of darkness, daylight. Instead of satisfied hatred, the dismay of guilt. Instead of freedom, the palsy of a new terror, a white dead face from which she was forever trying to flee, and forever held back. She remembered Deronda's words. They were continually recurring in her thought, turn your fear into a safeguard. Keep your dread fixed on the idea of increasing your remorse. Take your fear as a safeguard. It is like quickness of hearing. It may make consequences passionately present to you. And so it was. In Gwendolyn's consciousness, temptation and dread met, and stared like two pale phantoms, each seeing itself in the other, each obstructed by its own image. And all the while her fuller self beheld the apparitions, and sobbed for deliverance from them. Inarticulate prayers, no more definite than a cry, often swept out from her into the vast silence, unbroken except by her husband's breathing, or the plash of the wave, or the creaking of the masts. But if ever she thought of definite help, it took the form of Deronda's presence and words, of the sympathy he might have for her, of the direction he might give her. It was sometimes after a white-lipped, fierce-eyed temptation with murdering fingers had made its demon visit, that these best moments of inward crying and clinging for rescue would come to her, and she would lie with wide-open eyes in which the rising tear seemed a blessing, and the thought, I will not mind, if I can keep from getting wicked, seemed an answer to the indefinite prayer. So the days passed, taking with them light breezes beyond and about the Balearic Isles, and then to Sardinia, and then with gentle change persuading them northward again toward Corsica. But this floating, gentle wafted existence, with its apparently peaceful influences, was becoming as bad as a nightmare to Gwendolyn. How long are we to be yachting? She ventured to ask one day, after they had been touching at Ajaccio, and the mere fact of change in going ashore had given her a relief from some of the thoughts which seemed now to cling about the very rigging of the vessel, mix with the air in the red silk cabin below, and make the smell of the sea odious. What else should we do? Said Grandcourt. I'm not tired of it. I don't see why we shouldn't stay out any length of time. There's less to bore one in this way. And where would you go to? I'm sick of foreign places. And we shall have enough of Rylands. Would you rather be at Rylands? Oh, no, said Gwendolyn, indifferently, finding all places alike undescribable, as soon as she imagined herself and her husband in them. I only wondered how long you would like this. I like yachting longer than anything else, said Grandcourt. And I had none last year. I suppose you are beginning to tire of it. Women are so confoundedly whimsical. They expect everything to give way to them. Oh, dear, no, said Gwendolyn, letting out her scorn in a flute-like tone. I never expect you to give way. Why should I? Said Grandcourt, with his inward voice, looking at her, and then choosing an orange, for they were at table. She made up her mind to a length of yachting that she could not see beyond. But the next day, after a squall which had made her rather ill for the first time, he came down to her and said, there's been the devil's own work in the night. The skipper says we shall have to stay at Genoa for a week while things are set right. Do you mind that? Said Gwendolyn, who lay looking very white amidst her white drapery. I should think so. Who wants to be broiling at Genoa? It will be a change, said Gwendolyn, made a little incautious by her languor. I don't want any change. Besides, the place is intolerable, and one can't move along the roads. I shall go out in a boat, as I used to do, and manage it myself. One can get a few hours every day in that way instead of... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.